you're very welcome to Long Reads, a Jacobin podcast where we look in depth at political topics and thinkers. My name's Daniel Finn. I'm the features editor here at Jacobin, and I'll be presenting the show. At the end of last year, the French politician Jacques Delors died at the age of 98. Delors is best remembered for his time as president of the European Commission from the mid-1980s to the mid-1990s. During that time, the European Community became the European Union. The Delors Commission also laid the groundwork for the single currency through the Maastricht Treaty. One of the main ideas associated with Delors was the concept of a social Europe. Our guest today is Aurélie Dayanara. She's a research fellow at the University of Avery in Paris. Her book, Social Europe, The Road Not Taken, The Left and European Integration in the Long 1970s, was published in 2022. As Aurélie explains, the idea of social Europe originated in the crisis of global capitalism during the 1970s. When it was taken up by Delors and his commission, it lost its radical connotations and eventually became an alibi for the neoliberal framework of the Eurozone. Before people began talking about the idea of a social Europe in the 1970s, what was the nature of the European project actually existing as it had developed from the Treaty of Rome onwards up to the entry of states like Britain, Ireland and Denmark in the mid-1970s?
Post-war European integration is generally presented in the official discourse of the European Union and in mainstream political and media discourse as very much a peace project after the Second World War, a project of a few visionary fathers of Europe like Jean Monnet, Alcide de Gasperi, Konrad Adenauer, and so on. But in fact, it was really mostly an economic project that was led by conservative, Christian democratic, and liberal forces, right? And socialist forces were really marginal in the first years of this integration process. And communist forces were plainly absent from European institutions until the late 60s and early 70s. So the Treaty of Rome was signed in 1957. And it established the European Economic Community, which is the forerunner of today's European Union. And it created in 1957 a common market and a customs union among the founding members, the first members of the European Community, which were Belgium, France, West Germany, Italy, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands, right? And the treaty really marked, after a lot of discussions and preparatory works, preparation works, the victory of a liberal vision of economic integration to the disadvantage of other visions and of more social vision with social harmonization. So to give you an idea, in total in the Treaty of Rome, only 12 out of 248 articles were devoted to social policy. And out of these 12 articles, a lot of them were quite irrelevant. The only really relevant ones were three articles, one on an article that created a European Social Fund, basically an instrument which wasn't efficient and had very limited fundings, at least until the late 1960s. Then there was a second important article on equal pay for men and women within the European Community. But again, this was not applied until at least the late 1970s. And then there was a third article, which was quite relevant, on non-discrimination in working conditions and in access to social protection for workers that were moving between different member states, right? So migrant workers within the European Community. And again, this article was not applied until much later, at least the end of the 60s. So to simplify, the general conviction of the people who drafted the treaty and the people, the leaders, European leaders and governments who signed the treaty, was that social progress would naturally follow from economic prosperity, that the European Community would create economic prosperity and this would naturally create social progress. And of course, this did not happen, but things remained pretty much unchanged. This sort of social deficit of European integration plans remained pretty much the same until the late 1960s.
Northolt Airport, the Guard of Honor comes to attention under the West German and RAF flags as Dr. Adenauer, Chancellor of West Germany, arrives on a 5 days visit.
One of the main architects of European integration in the 1950s was the West German leader Konrad Adenauer. Adenauer lobbied for the release of German war criminals and employed former Nazis in his government. This newsreel from 1951 reported on his trip to London to help consolidate the Western alliance against the Soviet Union.
To Pathé News, he speaks through an interpreter.
Ich bin der britischen Regierung.
I'm very grateful to His Majesty's government for the invitation to come to London.
Ich hoffe von Herzen, dass
it is my cordial hope that the talks which I can have here will contribute to peace and understanding all over the world.
In 1958, Adenauer travelled to France to meet the country's new leader, Charles de Gaulle.
Carrying West German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer for the first meeting between the continent's two top statesmen, each a powerful personality in his own right, as well as a great national leader. Their meeting has an important outcome in de Gaulle's assurance that France will continue to work for close-linked continental defense and economic programs. Together, they call for an end to the ancient enmity between the two nations as essential to the future of free Europe.
De Gaulle was an independent-minded leader who would later pull France out of NATO's command structure. But Adenauer and his West German allies were always firmly committed to the alliance with Washington. In 1961, he went on a trip across the Atlantic to make some new friends in Texas.
The Texas spirit enters the usually austere chancellor as he beamingly accepts the state's unofficial symbol, the noble 10-gallon hat. If he goes back to Bonn with a sheriff's badge too, why, it wouldn't surprise Texas at all.
During this period, how did the left-wing parties of Western Europe, both social democratic and communist, perceive and respond to the idea of European integration?
European unity, as you may know, has been one of the most contentious questions for the European left in the 20th century. And this was particularly the case in different moments, but one of them was just after the Second World War, for post-Second World War plans for Western European integration, which started in 1947 with the Marshall Plan, right? This European recovery program financed by US loans, and which, of course, was intertwined, as other plans of European integration in those years, with the beginning of the Cold War and the dynamics of the Cold War, right? So communist parties and communist trade unions were unanimously hostile to the Marshall Plan, to start with, and to later projects of European integration. For example, the European Coal and Steel Community that was created in 1951, the European Economic Community in 1957, and so on. So in the view of communist parties and communist trade unions, these projects of European unity were really instrumental to isolating the Soviet Union, to dividing the European continent and the world more generally in two blocks, rallying Western Europe to a Western bloc and placing it under US hegemony. And they really denounced those projects, those early projects of Western European integration as capitalist, bourgeois, Catholic, militaristic, and also imperialist and colonial. And this started to change a little bit in the 60s, especially at the end of the 60s and in the early 70s. So communist trade unions were the first to change their attitude towards the European Economic Community and its common market, which in those years they started to view not so much anymore as something that needed to be combated from outside and abolished from outside, but as something that could be changed from within, that could be improved from working within, right? And so did the communist parties, starting with the Italian Communist Party, where there was a group of pro-European reformers led by Giorgio Amendola. The French Communist Party, which was the other very important communist party in Western Europe historically in those years, was more hostile and more reluctant than the Italian Communist Party. But it also gradually shifted its position towards European reformism, what we could call a sort of communist European reformism during those years. So By the late 1960s and the early 1970s, communist trade unions and communist parties started to send representatives within European institutions and to take part in the European decision-making process, basically. And on the socialist side, things were a bit different. The situation was more complicated and also evolved during the first decades or the first years after the Second World War. So to simplify, there was a line that divided European socialists and social democrats into two broad camps regarding European integration, European unity. There was one camp comprising the French, the Belgian, Dutch and Luxembourgish socialists and social democrats who were in favor of economic and political integration and rather supported those early plans of European integration after the war. And then there was another camp, including the British Labour Party and the Scandinavian Social Democrats, which were opposed to supranational European unity. Then the German Social Democrats had a different sort of evolution. They were initially hostile. In the early 1950s, for example, their leader, Kurt Schumacher, used to warn and to denounce what he called the four European C's, which were capitalism, conservatism, clericalism, and cartels. So German social democrats were very hostile to early plans of European integration. But by 1957, when the Treaty of Rome was signed, they had shifted their position and they voted in favor of the Rome Treaty. Like all socialist parties of the six founding countries of the European Community, the British Labour Party, on the other hand, remained hostile or divided on the question up until the 80s and even after the UK, Denmark and Ireland joined the European Community in 1973. And I think that this initial hostility and these divisions were one of the many different reasons why the European left failed to influence the European integration process and to realize a quote-unquote social Europe in those years.
François Mitterrand was one of the most important figures on the European left from the 1960s to the 1990s. He spoke at UCLA in 1968, shortly after the famous student protests and the general strike in France. In this part of his talk, Mitterrand spoke about his enthusiasm for the European project. He criticized both de Gaulle and the French communists for their stance on the question of Europe.
The great debate which separates socialism and General de Gaulle is the question of Europe.
Faut-il donner à l'Europe occidentale?
Does Western Europe have to have a political and an organic unity?
C'est en 1949.
It was in 1949 that Jean Monnet and Robert Schuman launched the idea of a united Europe.
Malheureusement, cette idée nouvelle a coïncidé.
Unluckily, this was at the same time that the world was splitting into two factions under the Warsaw Pact and under the NATO Pact.
Aussi l'Europe, la construction européenne, est-elle apparue?
And therefore, the idea of Europe seemed to be a prolongation of American military might
et un moyen de lutter
and a way of fighting communism.
Le général de Gaulle a une position, je viens de le dire.
General de Gaulle has a hostile attitude towards America, towards Europe, but also the Communist Party holds this view.
Mais il ne faut pas confondre les deux positions.
But one must not mix these two positions.
Le général de Gaulle se détermine.
General de Gaulle uses his nationalistic system to prove this as a base.
Le Parti communiste, lui, refuse.
The Communist Party fights these two points, NATO and Common Europe, because they are enemies of American power.
Et soutient la puissance militaire soviétique.
Because they support the national might of Russia, the military might of Russia.
What impact did the economic crisis of the 1970s and the end of the post-war boom have on the development of the European project?
I would say that The crisis of the 1970s, the end of the post-war boom, was one of the factors that led European leaders to consider changes in European integration and their European unity projects during those years, to start imagining a European community with a human face. That was an expression they used at the time. But it really wasn't the only one, right? So, for example, there was May 68, and the important workers and students movement, but also the feminist and environmental movement that emerged in the late 60s and continued well into the 70s, and more generally, the intensification of the level of social conflict in Western Europe in those years. And this had an impact on European leaders, deciders, and on their higher consideration for social dimension of European integration in those years. And there was also another factor which is not really well known, but I think was important, which was the affirmation during those years from the late 50s onwards of a union of third world countries for a redistribution of power and wealth, for what they call the new international economic order in this period. And this had an influence on European deciders and especially on left-wing European leaders in those times. And then there was the fall of the Bretton Woods monetary system in the early 70s, the exhaustion of the post-war economic boom, of course, the economic crisis of the 70s, and the disintegration more generally of the so-called post-war compromise, which had characterized the sort of social balance, social peace of the so-called golden years of welfare capitalism in the 30 years after the Second World War in Western Europe, right? And all these changes during the long 1970s, so from the late 60s until the early 80s, all this contributed to opening a window of opportunity for new alternatives, for new possibilities, right? So in those years, and that's what I argue in my book and in my work generally, the European integration project, just like the world order more generally, seemed to be at a crossroads. And different roads could be taken, different radical divergent solutions were envisaged, were being formulated and discussed during those years. And neoliberalism was only one of these several options. It was only one of the roads that were imagined and possible. And there were actually, alternatives during those years. And I like to tell this anecdote, which I think is quite interesting and a sort of ironic illustration of this tension in those years, that in 1974, the Nobel Economics Prize was jointly awarded to two rather completely contrasting thinkers. On one hand, the influential social democratic Swedish economist Gunnar Myrdal, and on the other hand, Austrian-British neoliberal champion Friedrich von Hayek, right? And so this tension during those years and this window of opportunity led the European left to start discussing and to start struggling for their social Europe project. And it was a time, and this is important to understand this story, it was a time when the European left was in a moment of important success, right? From the late 60s onwards, social democrats led governments across Western Europe, in Scandinavia, of course, which was their historic stronghold, but also in West Germany from 1969, in the Netherlands and in the UK in the 70s, in France in the beginning of the 80s. And also there were different countries in Europe, like Luxembourg and Italy, where social democrats or socialists were part of coalition governments. And at the same time, Western European communists had very significant electoral successes, especially in France and in Italy. And European trade unions also were reaching a peak in terms of membership and in terms of combativity. So the European left generally could hope to influence much more the European integration process, European policies, and to change Europe from within. And during the long 1970s, socialist parties and trade unions, but also to a lesser extent communist parties, started to improve their transnational cooperation in order to be able to better influence European policy. So, for instance, in 1974, the Confederation of Socialist Parties of the European Community was created, which was the forerunner of today's Party of European Socialists. And in 1973, the European Trade Union Confederation was created, which was a regional trade union organization that united for the first time since the beginning of the Cold War, trade unions from social democratic, Christian socialist and communist traditions, right, which had been divided since the Cold War. And now this new organization represented around 40 million workers and could really hope to weigh on European decisions much more than in the past.
In 1972, the Council of Europe voted to adopt Beethoven's Ode to Joy as the anthem of the European community. The previous year, this electronic version by Wendy Carlos was released as part of the soundtrack for Stanley Kubrick's film A Clockwork Orange. European officials would probably have liked the combination of European high culture with modern technology, although they might not have felt the same way about the association with psychopathic violence and totalitarian state control in the rest of the movie. So as you said, this was a moment in European and world politics when everything seemed to be up for grabs in a sense, and there were various ideas being canvassed, and political forces of the left of various kinds had significant political positions and assets at their disposal. So in this context, what were some of the main plans and proposals that were put forward on the European left during the 1970s for new forms of European cooperation that might better facilitate their own objectives? And did any of those plans, the ideas that you refer to as the road not taken, or perhaps several roads not taken, actually come close to being realized?
This Social Europe project was imagined during those years primarily by European socialists and social democrats and by the main European trade unions, especially organized in this European Trade Union Confederation I was talking about. And they were shared to some extent by European communists. And this Social Europe project aspired, for example, to use European institutions to regulate the economy, plan and democratize the economy, to harmonize social and fiscal regimes at the European level, to raise living standards and working conditions, to shorten working hours and so on, and to generally use a series of proposals that would generally shift the balance of forces in society, in the European community, in favor of workers instead of in favor of capital, right? And also, the Social Europe project included environmental concerns. They were also including proposals for democratization of European institutions, which were considered by the left anti-democratic or ademocratic. And it included also aspirations to rebalance the international economic order in favor of the so-called third world, right? Now, did any of these plans come close to being realized? Yes and no. So in the 1970s, several of these Social Europe proposals made their way onto the European agenda, and the efforts of the European left were crucial, for example, in the adoption of the first social action program in 1974 by the European communities. And this resulted in the adoption of a number of measures and of directives. Directives are European laws, right? And this included, for example, the enhancements of the European Social Fund that I was talking about before, the creation of different European agencies for vocational training and for working conditions. But progress was most important with regard to gender equality and health and safety at work. And there was a series of directives adopted by the Council in the second half of the 70s and in the 80s with regard to these two fields. But it's important really to underline that the main proposals of the Social Europe project imagined by the left during these long 1970s were never implemented, were never realized. And I can give you two examples of prominent campaigns and struggles of the European left during those years, which were defeated. One example is the battle for an alternative economic strategy in support of full employment, in which the European left really decided to highlight one demand in particular, which was the reduction of working time without wage losses. This was the big campaign of the European left in the late 70s and early 80s. And this battle went on for several years, and I can't get into the detail right now, but the European Trade Union Confederation even organized its first European demonstrations all across the European communities and even beyond the European communities in support of this campaign in the late 1970s and early 80s. But this led to basically nothing, next to nothing. The European Council only adopted a non-binding and very unambitious recommendation on this topic in 1984. And then another important battle of the European left during those years was the battle for a democratization of the workplace and the economy. This was a very important topic at the time. And this led in 1980 to the proposal of a European directive for workers' rights to information and consultation in multinational companies. This is the so-called Vredelin Directive, after the name of the Social Affairs Commissioner, European Commissioner, Henk Vredelin, who was a Dutch social democrat and who had pushed for this directive proposal. And of course, this directive proposal provoked very strong hostility from employers and from business circles, and also some important opposition within European institutions, so within the European Commission and within the Council. And in the end, basically, the directive was buried after years of discussion in European institutions. It was buried by the European Council in 1986. And there would be later directives on these questions, on these two questions in the 90s and 2000s, but which were much less ambitious than what the European trade unions and the European left had striven for in the long 1970s.
In 1977, with the future of Europe still up for grabs, the German group Kraftwerk released their album Trans-Europe Express. The opening track, Europe Endless, expressed a sense of boundless possibilities. With their songs about motorways and railway journeys, robots and pocket calculators, Kraftwerk perfectly captured a certain view of European modernity. They became Germany's most important cultural export since the last days of the Weimar Republic.
If we turn now to the way that the European project actually did develop coming out of this moment of crisis and possibility, can you tell us something about the political background of Jacques Delors before he became the president of the European Commission, surely the most influential president the Commission had had up to that point, and indeed since then? And what role had he played in the government of François Mitterrand as a minister during the early 1980s?
So I don't know how much Delors is known outside of Europe, in the US, I suppose not so much, but he's quite a notorious political figure in France and in Europe, right? When he died a couple of months ago, I think it was at the end of December, the whole political and media elites were unanimous in praising his role as a great European. And what is interesting is that before becoming president of the European Commission, Delors had been really a key player in the French left's liberal turn in the 1980s. His political trajectory basically was that of a social democratic reformist who served on the radical wave of the 1970s before rallying to economic liberalism in the 1980s. Delors was a convinced social Christian. He was a member of a Christian social trade union for all his life. He had been working at the Banque de France, the national bank. He's been a member of the General Planning Commission, so the National French Planning Commission. And then he had been special advisor to Georges Pompidou's Gaullist Prime Minister Jacques Chaban-Delmas during the early 1970s. And in 1974, he joined the Socialist Party. And the Socialist Party had recently reorganized the fragmented forces of French socialism under the lead of François Mitterrand. In those years, the Socialist Party had adopted a common program of government with the French Communist Party. And in those years, the Socialist Party was advocating nothing less than a rupture with capitalism, right? Those are the words that were used by its leader, Mitterrand, in those years. And I think it's really striking that during the 70s, like the rest of the French New Left that we call Second Left often in France, Jacques Delors was advocating a decentralizing self-management socialism. He was advocating socialist planning in France and in Europe. And this changed very much in the 1980s, right? So then in May 1981, after 23 years of right-wing government in France, the left won the presidential election. Mitterrand was elected president and the socialist government took over, which was joined even by four communist ministers a few months later. And Jacques Delors was appointed finance minister at this time. And at the beginning, the new government passed many major radical social and economic reforms, including, for example, extensive nationalization of industry and banks, mass hiring in the public sector, a rise in minimum wage, a rise in pensions, broad Keynesian stimulus plan, and so on. But at the same time, unfortunately, France's main commercial partners, trade partners, starting with Helmut Schmidt and Helmut Kohl's West Germany, and of course also Margaret Thatcher's United Kingdom, they were adopting deflationary austerity policies as a response to the economic crisis of the time, in complete contrast with what the left was doing in France, right? And so as a result, France got confronted with increasing trade deficit and increasing budget deficit, but also with speculation and continued downward pressure on its currency and increasing difficulty to find loans and to finance its budget and its expenses. And it's also important to say that France was a member of the European Monetary System, which was the forerunner of the current monetary union, European Monetary Union. And this European monetary system already limited the country's monetary leeway, right? And so as a result of all this situation, in March 1983, after three devaluations of its currency, the French government had to choose basically between sticking to the program, the socialist program, on which it had been elected, which implied leaving the European monetary system, or the other way around, basically abandoning the socialist program on which it had been elected in order to remain in the European monetary system. And it opted to abandon its program. And after 1983, it carried out a very radical change of economic policy. So basically, the French government turned to deflationary policies, budget restrictions, a reversal of nationalizations, progressive financial deregulation, and so on. And this austerity turn, which is called in French the tournant de la rigueur, and which really remains up until today a trauma, a collective trauma for the left in France, this turn was undertaken in the name of Europe, but also under the influence and the lead of Jacques Delors as finance minister, right?
Je ne sais que ça peut être autrement.
Sans chômage.
This was the song for Mitterrand's presidential campaign in 1981. The lyrics convey a sense of hope and urgency, telling the people of France that it's possible for life to be different with a new leader in charge. By the time Mitterrand died in 1996, the BBC could present him as one of the gravediggers of European socialism. This is how the report summed up his career from the late 1960s.
Mitterrand turned the left into a force in France for the first time since the war. But the promise of 81 didn't last long. 2 years later, faced with either abandoning the European monetary system or abandoning his socialist policies, Mitterrand did a U-turn, ditching the communists and abandoning socialism. It was a defining moment for the left in Europe. And it was the beginning of a long decline for the socialists. By 1986, Mitterrand was presiding over a conservative government and the fascist National Front was on the rise. By 1993, the socialists were crushed as a serious political force. But long before then, François, the socialist, who'd clung to power through all of this, had become François, the world statesman.
When Delors took up his position as the European Commission president in the mid-1980s, how did he adopt and, in his own way, transform the idea of social Europe? And what steps did he take as Commission president to implement that vision?
Yeah, so Delors, as you may know, is usually depicted not just as a great European, as I said before, but as really the father of social Europe. And that's for his role in when he was at the head of the European Commission in institutionalizing so-called European social dialogue, in strengthening European social and cohesion funds, and also in increasing European competences and regulation in the social field. But in reality, if you look at what he's been doing right after he took office as the new Commission president in 1985, Delors really actually placed economic liberalization at the top of his agenda with the single market project, right? So the single market project basically had the objective of completing the European community's already existing internal market with the removal of all the remaining obstacles to the free movement of goods, capital, services, and interior people. And this was supported basically by all European governments and especially, of course, by Margaret Thatcher in the UK and Helmut Kohl in West Germany. So basically by the most liberal, neoliberal governments. And it should be said also that pressures from the various business lobbies were really crucial in shaping the single market program, especially pressures from the European Roundtable of Industrials, the ERT, which was created in 1983 and which included basically the CEOs of 17 top European transnational corporations at the beginning. So, for example, Volvo, Nestle, Fiat, Philips, and so on. And so clearly, the rationale of the single market program, which was then institutionalized by the 1986 Single European Act, another European treaty, was very much free market oriented. And in the following years, for instance, in application of this program, some critical directives were adopted regarding the liberalization of capital movement and deregulation of banking and insurance sectors. At the same time, it's true that Delors and his administration in the European Commission hope to cash in on the success of the single market program with new initiatives, including initiatives in the social field, okay? But unfortunately, well, Delors, he had been in the Socialist Party in the 70s, and he knew the Social Europe project. He'd been part, actually, of the works, of the preparation of this, and the formulation of this project. But unfortunately, the social aspects of his agenda did not have the same success as the economic aspects. So, for example, the so-called Delors packages that he was putting forward during his time at the commission were adopted after a lot of negotiations within European institutions and between member states, which increased the funds for economic and social cohesion. But their fundings remained limited, right? And the overall budget of the European communities and the European Union remained limited, and therefore the potential of the European community and union for social and regional redistribution has always been very limited. And it remains the same today. Even now, the budget of the European Union barely exceeds 1% of the European GDP. And another example of how sort of the social dimension of the activism of Jacques Delors was weaker than his economic successes was in 1989, basically a charter of the fundamental social rights of workers was adopted, which had been a demand of the European left, of European trade unions for several years. And it was adopted and it did proclaim several social and economic rights, but it was non-binding. And the social action program, which was adopted the same year to implement this charter, right, consisted only of 47 instruments compared to the nearly 300 instruments for the single market program. And most of these 47 instruments were actually non-binding recommendations and opinions, right?
In 1993, the Dutch-Belgian group Two Unlimited released this track. It topped the charts in 12 of the 15 countries that would belong to the expanded European Union by the mid-1990s. In the same year, another product of the Low Countries, the Maastricht Treaty, came into effect. It's not clear if Two Unlimited had read the Maastricht Treaty or if Jacques Delors had ever listened to their music. But the lyrics do express a form of Euro-optimism that was rampant in the early 90s after the fall of the Berlin Wall. By the time Delors stepped down as president, the European community had become the European Union, and it also had several new member states. How had it changed during the same period in terms of quality rather than quantity or nomenclature?
So Delors remained for 10 years at the head of the commission between 1985 and 1995. And qualitatively, the main changes or the main change of the European community, which became the European Union in 1993 after the Maastricht Treaty, right? So the main change, aside from the single market and economic liberalization, was, of course, monetary union, this European monetary union, which was a very important qualitative change. And this turned out to be Delors' greatest political success, actually. So to explain just in a few words, in 1988, the European Council appointed Delors to chair a committee composed largely of European central bankers to make new proposals for the realization of economic and monetary union. Right. And then the Delors report was released a year later, and it was adopted by European governments in 1989, and it set the course for monetary union. It was then enshrined in the Maastricht Treaty, which was signed in 1992. And the core of this new treaty was the commitment of the member states, except the UK and Denmark, to adopt a single currency under the authority of a single independent central bank by 2000. And this was a very important decision because it meant that European governments would abandon key aspects of national economic and monetary sovereignty, starting with their right to issue money and to alter exchange rates, right? And The treaty also formally introduced for the first time the so-called convergence criteria, also called the Maastricht criteria, that set basically mandatory rules regarding the member states' economic policies. For example, it limited government budgets deficits to 3% of their GDP, their public debt to 60% of their GDP. It pushed them to keep inflation rates low and so on. And actually, much to Delors' regret at that time, the negotiators of the Maastricht Treaty refused to include convergence criteria on employment rates, so on basically social aspects. There were also other qualitative changes during those years with, for example, more integration in the fields of security and foreign policy, or more progress in the fields of justice and police coordination. But the main changes really during those years were, I would say, the single market and the European Monetary Union, which really constitutionalized the neoliberal turn of the European Union during those years.
In 1988, Jacques Delors made an appearance at a national trade union conference in Britain, where he spoke about his vision of a social Europe. The delegates gave him a standing ovation. A few weeks later, Margaret Thatcher hit back with a speech of her own in Bruges.
I am the first to say that on many great issues, the countries of Europe should try to speak with a single voice.
Thatcher railed against the idea of using the European Union as a vehicle for social democracy.
But working more closely together does not require power to be centralized in Brussels or decisions to be taken by an appointed bureaucracy. We have not successfully rolled back the frontiers of the state in Britain, only to see them reimposed at a European level, with a European superstate exercising a new dominance from Brussels. If Europe is to flourish and create the jobs of the future, enterprise is the key. The lesson of the economic history of Europe in the 70s and 80s is that central planning and detailed control don't work. By getting rid of barriers, by making it possible for companies to operate on a European scale, we can best compete with the United States, Japan, and the other new economic powers emerging in Asia and elsewhere. And that means action to free markets, action to widen choice, action to reduce government intervention. Our aim should not be more and more detailed regulation from the center. It should be to deregulate and to remove the constraints on trade.
Delors became a hate figure for the British right-wing press. The Sun newspaper famously ran a front-page story with the headline, "Up Yours, Delors." The man himself felt obliged to deny that he had any Napoleonic aspirations.
I don't want to be the emperor of the Europe. No.
What implications did the single market and the framework put in place by the Maastricht Treaty have for the idea of social Europe?
So I think it's quite obvious to most people that if you unleash trade and you liberalize services and you let capital move freely within the European Union or within any kind of regional trade area without prior fiscal and social harmonization, then you inevitably pit workers against each other and pit national welfare states, welfare regimes against each other. Okay, so the single market caused basically a race to the bottom over social rights, over salaries, over taxation, and over redistribution from the 1980s up until today. And this was actually obvious to the European left in the 1970s when they were, you know, discussing, formulating, imagining their project of a social Europe. And that's why they had been talking on and on about upward social and fiscal harmonization and about greater control over capital movement and multinational companies and about economic planning and so on, and not about deregulation or economic liberalization. Now, while the Single European Act in 86, and then the Maastricht Treaty in 92, liberalized the economy and imposed budget rigor. The social dimension of European integration that had been promised to trade unions and that had been promised to European populations continued to lag behind up until today. There was an agreement on social policy that was annexed to the Maastricht Treaty, but it only really scarcely increased the European competences in the social field, and it could not counterbalance, and this is really the important part, the social dimension that was developed really could not counterbalance the constitutionalizing of neoliberalism at the core of the new European Union. There was also a social protocol in the Maastricht Treaty, which institutionalized a new European social dialogue between employers, trade unions, and European institutions, but this really led to very few results, because given employers' reluctance and in the absence of pressure from European institutions and from member states, from governments, but also from below, from the rank and file, from social movements, this protocol couldn't bring much. And between 1990s and 2013, I think for the first 20 years of the application of this protocol, only three directives were passed under this procedure, on parental leave, on part-time work, and on fixed-term work. So the results were really very, very little. And by the 1990s, and today, I mean, it's quite obvious, Europe has been going further and further away from that social Europe project that the European left had been fighting for in the 1970s. And it was really going far from a market-controlling, redistributive, economic planning-oriented and democratized Europe at the service of workers that had been imagined by the European left then. And what was coming about was increasingly a neoliberal Europe whose social dimension was only compatible with free markets and with the extension of private property.
In the new century, the European Union welcomed some of the former communist states in the east of the continent. The Slovenian industrial group Laibach, who once issued their own passports to refugees from Bosnia, now took their place in the EU. The band released a track called Eurovision in 2014, at the high point of the Eurozone crisis. Europe is falling apart. Europe is falling apart. The lyrics weren't exactly subtle, but then neither was the political climate of the time.
Following on from that point, and I know this takes us past the period that you cover in your book, but after the financial crisis of 2008, we saw the European Union facing the greatest challenge, the greatest crisis in its history up to that point, in the form of the Eurozone crisis, which many people feared or even hoped might lead to the breakup of the European Union itself. How would you say we saw some of the legacies of Jacques Delors and the period in which he was the driving force at the Commission play out during that crisis and the way the European Union responded to it?
Well, the architecture of this European Economic and Monetary Union created by the Maastricht Treaty, following the Delors report, so following Delors' advice, transferred monetary policy of 20 countries of the Eurozone to the supranational level, and it deprived European countries from monetary tools that they were previously using to face economic difficulties, to regulate inflation and unemployment. And they were also limited in their investment capacities by the Maastricht criteria, right? With the independent European Central Bank that was aligned very much on German ordo-liberal monetary policy, which placed priority on the fight against inflation above anything else, especially above the fight against unemployment, and also with no real solidarity mechanism in the monetary union, this architecture could only turn into a straitjacket. And it was especially a straitjacket for economically weaker countries, countries that had traditionally had the weaker currency and had the weaker economies, like Greece, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, and so on. And it forced these countries to follow the rules of the stronger currency in the Eurozone, which has been and is up until today, the German Deutschmark. The Eurozone faced, of course, a very acute debt crisis after the 2008 financial shock, which lasted for many years, which really showed the negative impact of both liberalization, of course, but of this economic and monetary union, especially on weaker European economies. And Greece was the most the clearest, the most blatant example of this, right? Greece was hit very hard by the economic crisis after 2008 for different reasons that are structural to its economy. And its debt increased very sharply after 2008. And as a result, Greece was punished by the markets, which increased their borrowing rates and made it impossible for the country to finance its debt, right, to find loans to finance its expenses. And this pushed the Greek government to ask for loans from the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and from the European Union. And it's actually important also to say that the risk of a default payment or default of payment by the Greek government threatened directly the banks of other European countries, mainly French and German banks, which had massively invested in Greek state bonds and the Greek economy in the previous years. And so this is also the reason why the so-called Troika, so European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the IMF in those years forced the Greeks to accept loans of, I think, over 110 billion euros, if I'm not mistaken, which were conditional on the adoption, the implementation of very severe austerity measures, like cuts on public services like health and education, destruction of the minimum wage, destruction of wage in general, destruction of the welfare state in Greece, and so on. And so to cut a long story short, the money went in good part to French and German banks, and the Greek economy was destroyed by these austerity measures. All right. And this was in great part because Greece had lost sovereignty over its monetary policy and because of the absence of a real solidarity mechanism in the European Monetary Union, and also, of course, because of the neoliberal Maastricht criteria.
When Euronews asked Delors about the crisis in 2011, his proposed remedy was to speed up the pace of integration.
Monsieur Delors, bonjour. Dites-nous avant toute chose, quels sont les sentiments que vous éprouvez.
Firstly, could you tell us how you feel when you see the European Union project in such difficulties?
I'm worried, and I have regrets. I especially regret that when the euro became operational, during the decision-making in 1997, they rejected my idea for an economic policy coordination pact alongside the Stability and Growth Pact.
Who rejected it?
I think the heads of governments rejected it. If we had had that, the euro wouldn't have covered up mistakes made by certain people. But it would have stimulated the euro, and also in discussions with each other, they would have noticed that private debt in Spain was mounting to dangerously high levels, that the Irish government was turning a blind eye to the mad deals made by the banks, etc., etc. But they didn't do it.
But why?
Why? Because leaving aside this business of the Economic Policy Coordination Pact, which they're now coming back to in one form or another, but it's a bit late now. The problem which has arisen from the Greek difficulties is simple. Do we apply the no bailout as written in the treaty, which states that there will be no systematic help for a state which runs into difficulties? Or does the Eurogroup feel that it is morally responsible for not letting the situation worsen in these countries, and that being morally responsible, it takes political decisions to address the problem? That's the idea I've been putting forward, especially to the Germans, telling them, but we are collectively responsible. We cannot simply point the finger at the naughty Greeks.
particularly in the light of the Eurozone crisis, the question of the European Union and the question of whether it can be reformed has been one of the major controversies for the European left over the last 15 years or so. What do you think the long-term historical perspective that you set out in your work can bring to that debate?
Yeah, so this is a good question, a question that I've been asking myself very much in my work and writing my book. And well, I think that the European left's failure to build a social or socialist Europe during the long 1970s holds important lessons for the left today. I think on one hand, and most importantly, it really suggests a need for a certain degree of pessimism, actually a very significant degree of pessimism, I think, about the possibility of ever turning the EU into an instrument for social, democratic and ecological progress. Okay, and I think it is really worth emphasizing in this regard that in the long 1970s, the balance of power was much more favorable to the labor movement and much more favorable to the left than it is today, right? And the framework of European governance, European socio-economic governance, was much more malleable than it is today, when there were only 6 or 9 or 10 countries around the European table. And now today, with 27 member states sitting at the council table, and with neoliberalism really more deeply anchored in European treaties and policies, I think that attempts to reimagine a social Europe for the 21st century appears more and more like a fantasy, less and less likely. In recent years, the COVID crisis had forced European leaders to open tiny breaches in the so-called Maastricht consensus, right? You remember that the Stability Pact, for example, has been suspended for several years. But conservative forces are already busy reimposing these rules and reasserting austerity. So just a few weeks ago, for instance, the European Council announced massive cuts in the European Union public spending. So I think there would be, reasons for high pessimism in this regard. But at the same time, I think that for those on the left who still believe the EU can be changed, or perhaps that the EU could be supplanted by another type of European cooperation, another type of European unity, I think that this historical perspective and this forgotten defeat of social Europe is really an invitation to work relentlessly to overcome internal divisions and strategic weaknesses on the left. Basically, this story of a defeat, the lesson of this story of a defeat is that the left has to invest much more on internationalism, right? And some people on the left today think there are reasons to be optimistic, as in a way, social democratic, green and radical left parties, but also trade unions and civil society are better organized at the European level than they used to be a few decades ago. And today, citizens are more attentive to European politics than they used to be. And also the climate crisis pushes people to think about issues transnationally in a way that didn't exist a few decades ago, until recently, actually. So this is true to some extent, but I think really that, a lesson of this road not taken, of this story of a defeat, is that in order to move the European project in a radically different direction, which is what we need, right? The left would have to build a genuinely transnational alliance, a sort of hegemonic bloc that is clearly opposed to the neoliberal and the reactionary versions of Europe. And the left would have to agree on a common program that would be clearly oriented towards workers' interests. And the left would have to launch an offensive based also on mass mobilization, mass popular mobilization, working class mobilization. And we're very, very far today from being able to do this. And without this, the left will have little chance of succeeding in turning the European Union into a social Europe, or even just in turning the European Union into something that is less of an obstacle for any progressive social, economic and environmental transition in Europe.
Many thanks to Aurélie Dayanara for that discussion about the origins of the modern EU. Her book, Social Europe, The Road Not Taken, is available from Oxford University Press in open access form.